Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the program at any time of day. This site is made possible by Dotfoil Computer Services right here in Santa Fe on the web at dotfoil.com. Later in the program, we will be speaking to our foreign correspondent, Bill Burke-White, and we will also have a commentary from Ron Bloomberg. Right now, I'd like to welcome Joe Trogett. He is the curator of 20th century art here in Santa Fe at the Museum of Fine Arts, and we're talking about an exhibition that's opening this weekend called How the West is Won, The Art of New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you. Now, How the West is Won, one is spelled O-N-E. So this is a vision that basically challenges the tricultural myth of three separate and distinct cultures here in New Mexico and how that's reflected in the art of New Mexico.
That's right. We're using a reinstallation of our permanent collection at the Museum of Fine Arts to tell the history of New Mexico art from 1880 to the present. In recent years, that history has been broken into three cultural groups, and that sort of misinterprets the history. These groups have interacted with each other, they have borrowed ideas and materials from each other, and so the art of New Mexico is
not to mention intermarried and interbred with each other.
Yes, as well. But the art of New Mexico is really a fusion of cultural and artistic influences. So the oneness of New Mexico art is, in fact, that sense of fusion and hybridity.
Now, the Museum of Fine Arts goes back, it has been collecting for some time. How far does the permanent collection go back in history, and how did the museum start collecting art?
Well, the museum was started in 1917 with a new building on the plaza in Santa Fe. And the museum itself was the byproduct of a group of business interests in Santa Fe right after statehood that decided that tourism would be a very important economic base for the city. And those interests got together and created the Santa Fe Plan to create a tourist mecca and a tourist destination. And the creation of the Museum of Fine Arts as an institution was one of the first efforts to formalize that relationship with artists and with the community as a whole. The museum itself actually did not have a collection when it started, and so artists who were coming and working in New Mexico began leaving paintings and donating to the museum. So at the opening, there were 35 artists that showed at the museum, and the museum had a collection of about 20 pieces at that point. Now we have more than 20,000 pieces, and so the collection has grown very rapidly. The museum itself has played a very critical role in the development of New Mexico art from the opening in 1917 to the present. And the museum has had a very unusual history in that there really weren't curators at the beginning. Robert Henry, the New York painter, educator, and anarchist, was a great believer in democracy and an opponent of decision-making by curators or wealthy patrons or critics. And so he encouraged Edgar Hewitt, the director of the museum, to implement the open door policy, which stated very simply that anyone working in New Mexico as an artist could show at the museum. And so the museum was a very democratic institution until right after World War II, when the number of artists working in the state, when we say artists, what we really mean is European-American artists working in the state, was so large that it was no longer plausible to allow every artist working in the state to simply exhibit. And so a curatorial system was then instituted. But the collection has grown very rapidly over many years and is a very broad collection that really focuses on New Mexico art And in most cases, the collection really focuses on European-American artists. The new installation that will open Friday afternoon at 5:30, How the West Is Won, includes Native American, Hispanic, and Western arts from 1880 to the present. So this is a very broad look at New Mexico art. And we're using the collection of the Museum of Fine Arts with a few borrowed pieces from our sister institutions, the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture and the Museum of International Folk Art, to round out that history and really demonstrate visually how those fusions of aesthetic ideas have occurred over the last 125 years.
We're talking to Joe Troggitt, curator of 20th Century Art at the Museum of Fine Arts, and this exhibition of mostly the permanent collection of the Museum of Fine Arts opens this Saturday from 5:30 to 7:30, and it's accompanied by a major and beautiful book published by the Museum of New Mexico Press, which you wrote the essay in. And it's a great book for people who are interested in New Mexican art. And it's so interesting because when you flip through it, you know, I was reading the essay and I was also just going from beginning to end. And it's really a kind of New Mexican reflection of the styles of art happening in the rest of the world, but with a New Mexican flavor.
I think that's really true. There are 228 full-color reproductions that range from tourist icons to Agnes Martin. And so there is an incredible range of materials, and all of the arts of New Mexico are reflected in this history. And as you go page to page, there doesn't seem to be great shifts of aesthetic material. But if you flip through the pages very quickly, you'll see that there's an incredible range of materials that are represented not only in the book, The Art of New Mexico, but also in the exhibition that opens this Friday.
Now, let's talk about the tourist connection a little bit more. The railroads, toward the end of the last couple of decades of the 19th century, completely changed the West, and Santa Fe in particular. And one of the things that happened was that the desire to attract tourists to this place cultivated a kind of myth of New Mexico, the myth of the happy tricultural paradise, the myth of the noble savage, and so on. What did this, I mean, was there any reality in it? Was it just a fabrication of the hotels and the railroads?
No, there was certainly truth as well as myth. When the railroads came through New Mexico in the early 1880s and really connected New Mexico to the Midwest and to the West Coast, that signaled the end of the Spanish colonial traditions. It signaled changes in economy from the barter economy of New Mexico of the 19th century to a market economy. And that represented,
at least in the cities.
Well, in the cities, but throughout it. It marked the beginning of the end of 19th century ways. And part of that was the transformation of native-made goods and Hispanic-made goods into commodities that were then sold to outsiders. An incredible change. And so the art of New Mexico begins with that change and then develops through statehood and to the sort of classic representational images that we think of in the 19-teens. But at the same time that Western European-American artists were coming to New Mexico, there was a vibrant change in the Native American and Hispanic arts. And that is all reflected both in the exhibition that we are opening as well as in the catalog that goes along with that.
Now, you talk about a change in the Hispanic and Indian arts to commodities. Mm-hmm. What were they before?
Well, they were goods that were functional objects within the home and in the community. And so as pots and pans, cast iron skillets replaced ceramic pottery, for example, we have an incredible change, and those items that are no longer being used as functional objects were then traded to dealers in various commodities, and they were traded for modern machine-made items. And so that represents a huge change psychologically. But more importantly, in Santa Fe in the teens, there was an effort by Edgar Hewitt to do some social engineering with the native communities. And as weaving and pottery making and other crafts were functional objects, were no longer being made because they had been replaced by utilitarian machine-made goods, Hewitt tried very hard to reinvigorate the making of those objects, and so superimposed outsider European-American ideals onto the native traditions. And so this is another of those kinds of fusions that are discussed both in the book and in the exhibition.
What does it do to, let's say, a Pueblo culture when they're arts go from being utilitarian and functional to being commodities, and you start using not things that you make, but things that are machine-made?
Well, let's look at it from another perspective. When the modern artists came to New Mexico, they began to see the native-made goods not as artifacts or curios or images of the past, but began thinking of them as works of art in a Western sense. And as a result, when Morrison Hartley came to New Mexico and began to see the Pueblo dances, he began to think of those activities as America's original art form, and wrote articles about that that really played an important role within the artist communities of Santa Fe and Taos. And by thinking of those objects as art, when he would make a still life painting that would include a Pueblo pot and an Hispanic weaving, he wasn't just using curios from the cabinet in his studio. He was reflecting the idea that this is art about someone else's art, a very important changing conception. And as a result of this idea that amongst the modern artists of the community that Native American art was art, you began to see a rejection by the modern artists in the 1920s of the development of tourism and the creation of inexpensive tourist icons that have been demeaned as kitsch. And so there are a whole series of changes that take place in New Mexico around this idea of what is art and how do we think about it and who makes it.
And it's interesting because if you have an oil painting of a Pueblo pot or an Indian blanket, that's art. But you don't necessarily have in the collection the Pueblo pots and Indian blankets themselves, at least at the beginning.
That's right. And unfortunately, and many times when this material has been brought together, it hasn't been brought together to show how these artistic traditions have influenced each other. The Pueblo pot is being used as an ethnographic example to show that the painting was in fact accurate of someone else's creation. But that was not the same as saying that here is a tradition of Pueblo pottery, which is in fact an art form, and we need to think of that art form and that tradition as a parallel to European-American art.
And that underwent a change in sort of mid to late 20th century of what we consider art. What was the nature of that change and the catalyst for it?
Well, one of the catalysts was the feminist movement toward the end of the 20th century. Another catalyst for that was World War II. We are so familiar with Los Alamos and the bomb as being part of New Mexico history that we almost dismiss it as being an incredible influence on the arts of New Mexico. But the influence of World War II was to put to an end the kind of romantic outsider views of Native Americans and Hispanics. And so those romantic portraits that dominated the early 20th century art come to a screeching halt after the explosion of the first atomic bomb at the Trinity site. And as soldiers brought back horrible tales of World War II, the sort of romance of the way things weren't in the past simply had no meaning at the end of the 40s and the early 50s, and incredible changes take place in New Mexico art, reflecting an internalized view, reflecting psychology and the emotion of the artist, rather than these kind of illustrative depictions of someone else's culture. And as a result, within the Native American community, you have Fritz Scholder, you have T.C. Cannon, who then are using European American artistic techniques, pop art, and expressionist painting styles to then rethink the history of Native Americans in the 19th and the 20th century. And so the paintings that Scholder and Cannon made in the 1960s and 1970s play a critical role in opening up this idea of what constitutes art. And I think their works really answer your question, how the arts of New Mexico are then reflected back into changing ideas about arts or reflected back into Native arts.
We're talking about the exhibition that's opening this Friday called How the West is One, The Art of New Mexico. How have you organized the show in a different way than a curator might have organized it, say, 50 years ago, using some of the same objects?
Well, it's done chronologically, first of all. And by resetting the chronology, we get rid of some of the myths. One of the myths is that the Romantic painters associated with the Taos Society of Artists were the first artists to come to the region. Well, that implies that the only artists were European Americans, and so by showing European American, Hispanic, and Native American arts simultaneously through this exhibition, through time, you begin to see who was working at the same time and what they were reflecting and what they were responding to. The implication of the three cultures theory that was really invented and promoted by Edgar Hewitt is the idea that nobody was talking to anyone from another tradition. And I think what people will see when they come through How the West is One is that there is an incredible amount of cross-fertilization that is taking place, and that this really is one large artistic tradition with many, many subsets. I think oftentimes the language that we use is very difficult to express this kind of multiplicity of aesthetic ideas. And it's very easy to imply that when you use the term artist, that excludes Native Americans and Hispanics, and that it only refers to European American traditions. So I think as people walk through this new exhibition, they will see an incredible range of responses across what are traditional cultural lines.
And tell us, just in the minute or two that we have left, about this book. This is something that you've been working on for some time.
Well, this is 5 years in production, and it represents a very broad look at the arts of New Mexico. And as one flips through the book, you will see how these cultural fusions have occurred. And it's a very, very broad look at a tradition that is oftentimes dismissed as simply being easel paintings of Native subjects on one hand, or somehow contemporary art that seems to be a disjuncture from our artistic past. This is a synthesis of artistic ideas that presents a new way of thinking about the art of New Mexico in a much more holistic way. And I do apologize for the bad pun in the title, but I think it really does reflect a way of thinking about New Mexico art that doesn't simply empower one artistic tradition over another, but objectively looks at the interactions that have occurred.
And the bad pun in the title is How the West is One, O-N-E. It's the Art of New Mexico, and it's opening. The exhibition is opening on 5:30 this coming Friday at the Museum of Fine Arts. So,
well, thank you so much, and we do look forward to seeing people at the opening, and I think you'll see a new look at the collections of the Museum of Fine Arts.
And I want to say one more thing about the book. There's great photographs of New Mexico, of the museum in 1917, and the interiors of the galleries are remarkably similar to what you look at now when you go in there.
That's true, and the introductory exhibition in November of 1917 had our painting of Cui Bono, the Taos Pueblo man standing in front of the Pueblo, and that painting is back in this exhibition as well. So there's 90 years of art and art history that makes a full circle in this exhibition.
Joe Traugott is curator of 20th Century Art at the Museum of Fine Arts in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now and hear from Ron Bloomberg and some of our beloved underwriters. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with Bill Burke White, our foreign correspondent. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. Nobody asked me, but I'm starting to think Dick Cheney has morphed into a fictional character, like the Penguin in the Batman series. Well, the body language, the crooked smile. Caught him on Face the Nation. Bob Schieffer asked him if he had spoken to his dear friend and former chief of staff, Scooter Libby, since he was convicted of perjury. He actually answered, "There hasn't been an occasion to do so." Schieffer says, "You couldn't pick up the phone?" Cheney reiterates, "There hasn't been an occasion to do so." Huh? I know the occasion he's waiting for, the day Bush pardons Libby. And nobody asked me, but Don Imus will be back on the air with a national show within 6 months. Make it 6 weeks. That's a no-brainer. It's called Money. Nobody asked me, but I'd say five of the greatest songs ever written are These Foolish Things, In the Still of the Night, It Had to Be You, Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, and the Notre Dame fight song sung by Rod Stewart. And I would personally like to welcome Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson to Santa Fe. And though, as you can imagine, I'm incredibly busy, I would shuffle things around to have dinner with them. Let me just look at my schedule here. I'm free tomorrow, the day after, the day after, the day after. Actually, I have a colonoscopy on March 12, 2010. Otherwise, Valerie, Joe, let's do it. Let's catch the early bird special. And I'll talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
KSFR's own Ron Bloomberg can be heard each Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, Thursdays after the news at noon, and Saturdays after Bob Edwards, just before the 10 o'clock hour.
Witness the exploits of vaudevillian Velma Kelly and chorus girl Roxy Hart as they try to paw their way back into the spotlight from behind bars in the Chicago Cook County Jail in the 1920s. Chicago, the musical, a stage and screen success for over 30 years, comes to the College of Santa Fe during the last two weekends of April, opening on April 20th. For tickets, call the Greer Garson Theater box office at 473-6511. This message is sponsored by College of Santa Fe, a tax-exempt organization.
KSFR programming is underwritten by Locals Care. Locals Care community cards reward you for shopping and dining at over 100 locally owned businesses. You can support a Santa Fe nonprofit and earn rewards for yourself at any Locals Care business. Find program information and a current list of participating businesses and nonprofits at locals-care.com. Offered in cooperation with the Santa Fe Alliance and sponsored by Century Bank, Los Alamos National Bank, the New Mexican, and the City of Santa Fe.
I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Bill Burke White. He's our foreign correspondent. He's a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Bill, to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be with you as always, Mary Charlotte.
It's glad to be, as we're happy to have you too. We wanted to do today a little bit of a international roundup, starting with the Iranian-British hostage situation. What happened? Why did the Iranians take these British hostages, and why did they release them? What was going on?
Well, as most of your readers will recall, about, I guess, 3 weeks ago now, a number of British sailors were seized by the Iranian Navy. The British said that the sailors were in British territorial water. The Iranians claimed they were in, the British claimed they were in Iraqi territorial water, where they had a right to be, and the Iranians claimed they were in Iranian water. And this whole episode tells us a couple of really interesting things about what's going on in Iran. The first thing to note is this wasn't just that an Iranian naval patrol boat happened upon some Brits. This was clearly a coordinated, planned effort. You don't suddenly seize 18 British hostages without planning it. And what it appears was that this hostage seizure took place on the same day that the UN Security Council was going to vote on sanctions against Iran. And what appears to have happened is that Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, doesn't normally control the military. The military is controlled by the Ayatollah. And so it's this odd sort of governance where the president isn't actually in charge of the military. What seems to have happened was that Ahmadinejad has been trying to gain power vis-a-vis the clerics in this strange development where initially, in the last government in Iran, the elected president was far more liberal than the clerics, and with Ahmadinejad as president, it's reversed, and in fact the clerics are more liberal than the president. And it seems that Ahmadinejad has been trying to increase his power vis-a-vis the clerical establishment, the Ayatollah, and ordered the military, who he doesn't have direct control over, to seize these hostages as a bargaining chip for trying to prevent the Security Council of the United Nations from imposing sanctions on Iran. So Ahmadinejad, I think, was testing the waters to see if the military would in fact listen to him, and it appears that at least part of the Navy did, and that's somewhat troubling because, of course, Ahmadinejad has the most radical of ideologies in Iran, and it's not necessarily a good thing that he can order even a small part of the Navy to act. Then, however, the situation started to change, which is that then they had these hostages and no one knew quite what to do with them. The Security Council went ahead and imposed sanctions, and it got harder and harder for Iran to release the hostages because they had more sort of political capital at stake every day that went by that the hostages were in Iranian custody. It seems that Ahmadinejad wanted to keep the hostages, but that a schism started to develop or continued to develop between Ahmadinejad and his sort of radical group and the clerical establishment, in which the sort of pragmatic folks who are working for the Ayatollah and among the clerical establishment wanted to release the hostages, and Ahmadinejad wanted to keep them. And there's already a lot of tension between these two groups, the radicals, the fundamentalists, and the more pragmatic group. And it seems that the clerical establishment, this more pragmatic group, figured a way that they could actually use this episode to kind of temper Ahmadinejad's power. And eventually, Larjani, who's one of the closest aides and advisors to the Ayatollah, brokered the deal that eventually let the hostages go home. But in so doing, the clerical establishment reasserted power against Ahmadinejad. And I think at the end of the day, what we see is that the big loser in all of this is, in fact, the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad. He got sort of slapped on the wrist, or maybe even more than on the wrist, by the clerical establishment. And it became pretty clear, I think, to most people in Iran and observers elsewhere, that there was a growing divide between the pragmatists who worked for the Ayatollah and Ahmadinejad, and a real opportunity for the clerical pragmatists to reassert their power and try to rein in Ahmadinejad. And I think that's, at the end of the day, how the British hostages got home.
It sounds like it almost sounds like you're talking in oxymorons. You have liberal pragmatic clerics and then a radical fundamentalist secular president.
Yeah, it's the total reverse of what I think anyone would have expected. When the clerical establishment sort of allowed slightly more free elections about, you know, 8 or 10 years ago, we saw people like Rafsanjani and then Khatami as the president, and they represented the more liberal, democratic factions within the government. And then in the most recent election, just about 2 years ago now, there was a total reversal, and a fundamentalist who was even more fundamental than the clerics got elected. And Ahmadinejad got elected on a platform of economic reform and kind of religious values. He has failed to deliver on the economic reforms. His assertion of religious values, I think, has been troubling to many Iranians, and his desire to pick a fight with the West has, I think, shown some of the clerical establishment that they would be better off maybe not being warm and fuzzy with the United States, but at least having a normal relationship with Europe and not being in conflict with the United States. And so everyone now in Iran seems to be, to some degree, ganging up against Ahmadinejad. That doesn't mean he's about to fall from power, but it does mean that there is a real opportunity here for the United States and Europeans who want to see a different tone coming out of Iran, or even a different administration, which is that the clerical establishment is going to be picking a fight with Ahmadinejad over the coming years and trying to rein in his power, which is exactly what the United States wants or needs. And so it may be that the Iranian clerics actually are best friends in Iran going forward.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. Let's turn to Iraq. In Iraq, we have, I guess, what you would call a parliamentary crisis, a government in crisis. What's happening right there?
Yeah, it's sort of missed our news cycle in part because, of course, of the horrors at Virginia Tech yesterday. But yesterday, the six members of the Iraqi government, not the parliament, actual government ministers, withdrew from the government. They are the group that represents Muqtada al-Sadr, one of the most important clerics in Iraq. And they withdrew on al-Sadr's orders. He ordered them to leave the government in protest at the fact that the United States has still not set a timeline for withdrawal from Iraq, and that really precipitated a government crisis there. The problem, of course, is that the Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, needs the support of al-Sadr's group in order to continue to have a sort of coalition government, and now those six people are gone, and it's unclear whether the government will be able to maintain its hold on power. Now, there is a bright side to this, which is that the six ministers were not the most competent of the ministers in the Iraqi government, and it may be that they can be replaced with better people. The real danger, however, is that unless al-Sadr lends his support again to this government with perhaps new ministers in it, it is unclear whether they'll be able to maintain the kind of majority and political support they need to remain a governing faction. And given everything else that's going on in Iraq, a governmental crisis is not what anybody needs today.
It seems that there is a common thread among all the different factions in Iraq, which is that they all want the U.S. to pull out. Is that correct?
It's mostly correct. I think there is a definite sense in Iraq that they'd like a timetable for U.S. pullout. Not everyone would say the U.S. should be out today, but they'd like a concrete timetable with certain benchmarks as to when the United States will withdraw. At the same time, the Iraqi government is in support of this so-called troop surge that we currently have in Iraq. And I think what many people in Iraq would like to see is a successful troop surge followed by a U.S. withdrawal. Certainly, many of the opposition in Iraq or the insurgents clearly want the U.S. out now. I think the government wants the U.S. to develop a phased timetable to withdraw but not to completely disappear tomorrow morning.
Now, in the United States, how are we responding as, you know, as the people and as the government to that need, to that stated need of Iraqi people?
Well, clearly, you know, in the United States, there is a growing and now, I think, strongly felt desire for the U.S. to bring home the troops. The U.S. government has not responded to that desire. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, President Bush still believes that victory in Iraq is possible and so has opted to pursue what, you know, he has called this troop surge in an effort to try to quell the insurgents before he loses the ability to kind of maintain troops there. The closer it gets to elections in the U.S., the harder that becomes for him. So I think he has staked his bet on a troop surge followed by some kind of quick victory, rather than you know, recognizing the desire of the American people for troops to come home. And I think the growing desire in Iraq for some sort of phase timetable for U.S. troop withdrawal or redeployment. It doesn't seem to me likely that the current administration is going to change its view. They don't seem to learn from mistakes. It's also true, I should note, that the troop surge has been somewhat successful. Rather than in the past where our approach has been sort of we run through a neighborhood and try to rid it of insurgents and then move on, we've been trying to kind of hold territory. And in that respect, some areas of Baghdad have become safer and have a continued U.S. and or Iraqi military force there to keep them that way. Obviously, however, that hasn't stopped things like, you know, a bomb in the Green Zone in the Parliament cafeteria last week. So the success is relative of the Bush strategy, and it clearly doesn't does not reflect the will of the United States population, nor the kind of growing sentiments we're seeing in Baghdad.
If the United States were to withdraw either immediately or on a timetable over, say, the next year, what do you think would happen in Iraq?
It's very hard to predict, and it's always dangerous to sort of say, here's what will happen. But if one looks at what's going on in Iraq at the moment, is that, first of all, Muqtadir al-Sadr's Mehdi army has kind of gone underground in response to this troop surge and is waiting to see what happens. My guess is if the United States were to pull out tomorrow, that the Mehdi army would rise again. They haven't been destroyed. They have moved to some other towns where we don't have as strong a military presence at the moment. And that you would start to see serious population movements in Iraq. You would see Shiites moving to Shia areas, Sunnis moving to Sunni areas, and the Kurds remaining largely in the Kurdistani north. That's not necessarily because every individual Sunni hates every individual Shiite, but it's a matter of where do you feel safe. If there are armed gangs roaming the streets, you'd rather be in a territory where you have, you know, people who are more like you and who aren't trying or who aren't being attacked by militias. And so I think you would see a massive population redistribution. And that's problematic, because when people move in those kinds of contexts, people die. If one looks at, say, Kosovo or the former Yugoslavia, those are places where we saw these kind of massive population movements, and it usually involves some real nasty stuff, whether it being, you know, the torching of houses or the actual, you know, torture and murder of individuals. It's hard to say exactly what will happen, but I think we'll see a large population redistribution and a lot of blood in the process. I then think that the next thing that would happen is that there would be an ongoing conflict between the Sunni and Shia groups in Iraq over the oil. Unfortunately, the oil is not evenly distributed in Iraq, and so if people kind of move back to the territories where their population group is most, you know, densely populated, oil won't be evenly distributed, and I fear that you'll see a continued version of either you know, insurgency fighting or full-out civil war fighting over who controls those oil revenues. So I don't think the U.S. pulling out is a perfect solution. It might be the best among a number of bad options, because by staying in, we may just be preventing or delaying, I should say, the inevitability of that kind of clash. And it doesn't appear from anything in our current strategy that our continued presence does much other than delay that conflict. We're certainly not trying to solve the underlying tensions in any meaningful way.
I've heard reports, and many of them, where people are speaking from families where Sunnis and Shiites are married to one another, and the separation seems like it's not... I mean, there's so much intermingling, cultural and familial, and I'm wondering if there is a possibility of a multicultural secular society in Iraq, as you seem to have had under Saddam Hussein.
I hope in the long term, yes. There's a couple of real problems toward getting there. And I think you're right. There are a lot of Iraqis who live either in mixed families or mixed communities and are deeply integrated with one another. There's a couple of problems. The first problem is that at the moment there are armed thugs running the streets and in many cases controlling the streets. Those people have decided, for whatever set of reasons, to give their lives, essentially, for it appears they perceive as sort of an ethnic struggle for power and governance. And it seems very hard to get those people back into a kind of multi-ethnic community. It may be that you can build that community among ordinary Iraqis, and through those ordinary Iraqis put pressure on the militants, but I don't think the militants can be convinced to either take part in a multi-ethnic government or to lay down their weapons in favor of such a government. Think back, if you would, Mary Charlotte, for a minute to what happened, say, in Yugoslavia. Tito, of course, was the dictator there for much of the 70s and 80s. He kept an amazing lid on ethnic tensions. He was a strong man. Loyalties were owed to him, and if you didn't owe him loyalty, you feared him. And so other kinds of ethnic conflict were largely under the lid of the pot, if you will. Tito dies, and then suddenly those underlying ethnic and nationalist conflicts get to reemerge because the strongman's not there to keep everyone in line. And I think Saddam Hussein played largely a similar function. That's not to say that all Iraqis hated one another, but that with Saddam in power, those groups that did want to contest governance or fight a religious or ethnic struggle couldn't do so because Saddam had a monopoly on the power in the country. Remove Saddam, and it's not surprising that those underlying tensions boil over and you get the kind of conflict we have going on now. So while I think it's important to start working hard toward building that kind of a multi-ethnic community, particularly among ordinary Iraqis, it's not so easy just to hand power over and assume that with these militias in place that you'll have that multi-ethnic community emerge.
We're talking to foreign correspondent Bill Burke-White. Let's move over to the Sudan. There's actually been an agreement reached between Sudan and the UN. What's going on there?
Mary Charlotte, it's funny to think about the fact that there's huge developments going on in Africa at the moment, and they don't even make the New York Times or the major U.S. papers. If you want to read about them, you've got to go to the Times Online in London or the Sydney Morning Herald to find out what's going on in a part of the world that we really should be paying much more attention to. So in Sudan, as everyone knows, there's been an ongoing genocide in Darfur. Last month, I think we talked about the fact that the International Criminal Court had issued indictments of two of the leaders, one Sudanese government official and one member of the Janjaweed militia. There's been an ongoing effort to try to get peacekeepers on the ground in Darfur to prevent genocide. It's amazing how just a few UN peacekeepers in place can be reason for the Janjaweed not to come traipsing through a village committing slaughter. Not surprisingly, however, the government of the Sudan has refused to let UN peacekeepers on the ground. Instead, they've allowed 3,000 African Union peacekeepers on the ground. The African Union peacekeepers, however, are largely incompetent. If not incompetent, they don't have the mandate to do anything, and they alone cannot stop a genocide. They just either turn a blind eye because their own governments are in cahoots with the Sudan, or if they don't turn a blind eye, they don't have the power to, you know, to prevent attacks. There has been a push by the United Nations to get an additional 7,000 UN peacekeepers on the ground, and the Sudanese government has continued to buck calls from the UN to put those peacekeepers on the ground. What they agreed to this week was to allow UN helicopter gunships, helicopters, you know, armed with weapons, to patrol Darfur. And this is actually an important breakthrough because it means that for the first time in a very long time, UN observers will be able to see what's going on in the ground in Darfur and actually have a great deal of flexibility as to what they're looking at. If you're in a helicopter, you can get around the territory pretty quickly and monitor what's happening. Of course, the problem with a helicopter is that it's not the same as having troops on the ground. You can't relate to communities. You can't get a real sense of what's going on. You certainly can't arrest indicted Janjaweed officials because you're up in the air. So this is an important breakthrough, but it is not a solution to the crisis in Darfur. They've only allowed 6 helicopters to patrol at any given moment a territory that's I don't have the exact dimensions, but it's on the order of the size of New Mexico, and with 6 helicopters patrolling the whole country, they're going to miss a lot. But hopefully, this will be a step toward getting UN peacekeepers actually on the ground.
Why do the U.S. media pay so little attention to Darfur, to Africa?
The U.S. media, well, today, obviously, Virginia Tech is in the headlines, and rightfully so. But there's a couple things that have happened, one of which is that many newspapers have really scaled back their international coverage and focus basically now on Iraq and don't have the newsrooms to provide coverage as to what's going on in Africa. And it appears that people don't seem to care very much. If there's stories on Iraq, those are the stories that get read, and if there's stories on Africa, they seem to not, you know, get the same kind of readership. So I think it's both the news side and the public side. If the public's interested in these areas of the world, they need to let their newspapers know to cover them, or at least the sort of global papers that really can have press out in the field in places like Sudan.
I mean, it's sort of a vicious circle because we don't know that we're interested in something unless we read about it in the paper.
That's very true. I mean, and one of the things, of course, that's happened with the shift to, you know, much more news coming in alternate sources is that newspapers have been struggling. I'm here in Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia Inquirer has largely closed down its newsroom at this point, other than for, you know, local and regional news. And so you're left with, sort of 3 or 4 papers in the United States that have their own correspondents on the ground in places. And if the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, and the Chicago Tribune aren't covering it, there's no other real outlet for it. But if your readers are interested, get on the web, because there is a lot of good coverage of those regions in European papers, in South African papers, etc. And the great thing about the web is we can read whatever news we want.
Not to mention the BBC World Service, as we have it here on KSFR.
Absolutely.
Bill Burke-White, thank you so much for being with us. Bill Burke-White is our foreign correspondent, and he is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. We will see you next month.
I look forward to it. I'll be just back from Iran, and we can talk about what's going on the ground then. Take care and have a good one.
You too. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, and this program can be heard any time of day at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services of Santa Fe, on the web at dotfoil.com. You can reach me at the email address radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. Dream, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.